Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program to join the worldwide collective shock and grief at the near-total immolation of Notre Dame Cathedral. The only empathetic thing I thought I could do was watch the magnificent monument burn on live TV with most of the human world. And afterward, unable to be of any help, I dug out a DVD of the 1939 movie, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, with the incomparable Charles Laughton as Victor Hugo's protagonist, Quasimodo, and later listened to CDs by Edith Piaf and Django Reinhardt. I used to be a forest firefighter, a hotshot, and volunteer fireman, and 30 years ago survived a house fire in Astoria when a drunken man in an upstairs apartment lit a cigarette and fell asleep in the early morning of April 25th, 1989. He died. So I felt a particular empathetic sense of loss and acute inability to help half a world away. I generally regard April as a month of tremendous events, the advent of spring and resurrection, a contagion of chlorophyllitis. A case in point is KMUN's 36th birthday yesterday, April 17th. The North Oregon and South Washington coasts, public listener-owned radio pioneer at the mouth of the Columbia River. Liam Dunn's hearty voice announcing the birth of community radio all those years ago. And tomorrow, April 19th, is not only the birthday of KMUN's program director, Elizabeth Minitry. It is also the 244th anniversary of the storied midnight ride of Paul Revere and the start of the American Revolution, known as the shot heard round the world. And April is a month that the American Civil War began and ended, with 4 years of horrendous and bloody death and destruction in between, 1861 to 1865. Abraham Lincoln might be considered the last casualty of that war, assassinated on April 14, 1865. Shot on Friday and died the next morning, April 15th, belonging to the ages. Considered one of the three most remarkable presidents of the United States, Lincoln acts as a fulcrum for them. He and George Washington were born in February, and Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in this month of April. FDR on April 12, 1945, just before the end of World War II, and the consecration of his most cherished concept to preserve humanity from destroying itself in war, particularly in the very new probability of nuclear holocaust, the United Nations. Somewhat an irony, but the sinking of the unsinkable RMS Titanic parallels Lincoln's death 47 years later in 1912. The huge ship hit an iceberg the night of April 14th and capsized in the early morning of April 15th. Adolf Hitler, whom our current president seems to regard sympathetically, was born April 20th, 1889, 130 years ago, and suicided in a Berlin bunker in April 1945, when his holocaustic Nazi regime was defeated by Allied forces led primarily by Franklin Roosevelt. A century and a decade after Hitler's birth, on April 20th, 1999, two Colorado high school students voicing Hitler's name shot and killed 13 fellow students and wounded 23 others before suiciding like their idol at Columbine High School. The 20 years since have been an orgy of school massacres in America, and apparently another one threatened at Columbine. Today, April 18th, is the 113th anniversary of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire, which was a precursor of sorts to the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. Also today, in 1942, American bombers bombed the Japanese capital city of Tokyo 4 months after Pearl Harbor. The last survivor of the famous Doolittle raid, led by Colonel James Doolittle, died last Tuesday at age 103 He was Doolittle's co-pilot. And today, the greatest of all war correspondents, Ernie Pyle, was shot and killed in the last battle of World War II, that of the April Fool's Easter Sunday invasion of Okinawa. The rest of this program is dedicated to Ernie Pyle and to war reporters and photographers, civilian and military. I shall begin this with something I wrote, and I use a sort of third-person nom de plume. I call it Pyle Rideau. Dago Mack was a reporter, a United States Marine Corps combat correspondent, rifleman, and eyewitness. His job, as he saw it, was to be with the infantry, the self-styled grunts who lived, murdered, and died in mud and swill like pigs. He was one of a long line of USMC journalists that ostensibly began on the beach of Guadalcanal Island. He made a dramatic gesture while on Okinawa, waiting to be shipped down south to Vietnam. He hired a small boat and went out to the tiny island of Iwo Jima, which he knew he would find a dismal monument. Ernie Pyle was killed on Iwo Jima in the last and one of the bloodiest campaigns of the war he so eloquently reported. He had been called the little man's little man in a book by another reporter. Pyle had been loved by the soldiers because he wrote about them from their vantage, taking their risks and suffering their discomforts. He loved them in return. He was a small, frail man with a long, thin head, and he was always terrified. Somehow he found it in himself to go where the soldiers went, and toward the last, with Marines, the first few days on Okinawa. No newspaper man had ever been as close to or written so plainly intuitive of the common soldier who bears the weight of all wars. Dago Mack found the monument. It was smaller than he expected and thought it would be on a hill instead of a small, undistinguished valley. It was a stone marker that had replaced an original hand-lettered sign and later a marker, but the words were the same. At this spot, the 77th Infantry lost a buddy, Ernie Pyle, 18 April 1945. Dago Mack might have knelt if he did not think it unseemly. He stood instead with his hands clasped as in church. He made a promise that was more like a prayer. He promised to do what Pyle had done. He promised to stick with the grunts and write their stories no matter how scared and cowardly he was. He promised that though he might be of no other use, he would write honestly and lucidly of the men who were. He would write of their fear and pain, their laughter, their irreverence, their desperate prayers for continued life. He would love them, defend them, and stick with them through the worst. Most of all, he prayed he would keep his promise. Dago Mack kept most of his promises. He glued himself to the grunts and had seen and done things he wished he was never a part of. He learned to hate the grunts as much as he loved them. He hated their frail humanity that made them behave like savage animals. He hated their cruelty, their viciousness, their hatred and contempt for the Vietnamese. He hated himself for being indistinguishably one of them, for his indisputable loyalty to them. And that was something I wrote, sort of a nickname that I picked up as a kid, being Sicilian and Irish. And now, from the Washington Post. The Marines don't want you to see what happens when propaganda stops and combat begins. By Alex Horton. Marines pass a joint to one another in the dark void of southern Afghanistan, and in crackling night vision green, the question arises, did they think they would ever be stoned within range of enemy fire? The grunts take a moment to contemplate the infinite chasm between what the military wants you to believe happens in war and what unfolds in just another night in combat. You think the Marine Corps is a bunch of perfect people who don't do anything bad, don't curse, and they're just really squared away killers? One man says to another. The Marine Corps is filled with the most screwed up individuals I've ever met. He takes a drag. Just like me, you know. The Marine Corps, like other service branches, dispatches its media wing to curate its own version of war. Everyone knows the deal. the good will be widely distributed, and the violent, the illegal, and the inexplicable are wiped from existence. But the THC-laced epiphany halfway through the documentary, Combat Obscura, directed by former Marine videographer Miles Lugosi, is something different. Grunts posture and brood about war in the way they have seen men do in films, mindful that every second could be recorded. In this way, the camera documents reality as it simultaneously creates a version of it, a mix of therapy, confessional, and a mirror held up to young, grime-streaked faces. And it reveals shimmers of brutal honesty, perhaps only possible when a Marine records comrades overcome with an urge to speak freely, confident that what they say would be too honest and too raw to ever find its way to an audience. So why not be real? It replicates the rhythm of an actual deployment, Lugosi says, of the manic and at times confounding flow between scenes. The chaos, the mixed emotions, the paradoxes, he says. And yet the footage found its way out of Afghanistan, and the Marine Corps has fought to keep it under wraps. The Corps has good reason. The brass covets images of fresh-faced grunts handing coloring books to kids with a wink and a wave, along with Marines parroting the Pentagon's vague and confident optimism of elusive victory to come. Lugosi had marching orders to deliver such video. But the rest of the war unspooled in spurts of gore and mind-bending boredom over 8 months, much of it recorded by Lugosi and his fellow cameraman, Justin Loya, while assigned to the 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, in 2011. In one of the few title cards at the beginning of the film, he announces, "We filmed what they wanted, but then we kept shooting." The documentary, which premieres in select cities, is a patchwork, narrative-free dreamscape of a film. There are no voiceovers and few hints of the mission assigned to the Marines in the sand-swept villages around Kajaki in Afghanistan's perpetually violent Helmand province. In one scene, a Marine huffs hash smoke out of a Pringles can bong in a flash of ingenuity. In another, a grunt brandishes a pistol at four children riding donkeys so he can search them, roaring that he's looking for the Taliban. Then he smiles. "I'm just kidding. Here, chocolate," the Marine jokes. Other footage captures a confusing bedlam of firefights, including the adrenaline climb-down lulls rarely seen in sanitized clips prized by cable news. Those snippets, distributed by public affairs troops like Lugosi as fair use video, are frantic yet distant from the end product of violence, like a horror movie that never shows the monster. No Taliban fighters are ever seen in the film, but one dead body is shown, a shopkeeper. Afghan troops mull hiding his corpse, just like a deer, someone notes, as Marines flip his body over to inspect his wounds. The documentary implies he was innocent, though Marines in the unit have said the shopkeeper used a radio to communicate with militants, and the shot to kill him was approved by the chain of command. Various other scenes channel surreal flashes of banal violence, like Marines gathering fingerprints from the severed and scorched hand of a militant killed while planting an IED. Lugosi said films like Full Metal Jacket were embedded in his mind and guided how he thought about his shots, a feedback loop of war images becoming war images becoming war images. He brought back a cache of video and enrolled in film school at Columbia University, where he discovered he had something that could, in aggregate, approach the truth in ways that piecemeal clips on CNN could not. He watched another veteran, Matt Bissonnette, embroiled in a scandal after his book about the operation to kill Osama bin Laden allegedly revealed sensitive information. He submitted the documentary to Marine officials tasked with reviewing books and films for classified material. The officials found something else entirely. Lugosi was a self-interested threat to the safety of other Marines, the Marine Corps said, and his videos were evidence of crimes like smoking marijuana that have since passed the statute of limitations. Viewers wouldn't know the 21-year-old Lance Corporal Christopher P.J. Levy would die of his wounds 3 days later unless they punched his last name into a Google search. U.S. troops later withdrew from Helmand. In 2016, they returned to the provinces to help Afghan forces retake much of the same ground soaked with blood of men and women like Levy. Why were Levy and his fellow Marines in Helmand? Did they accomplish the mission? What was the mission anyway? The Pentagon doesn't have any good answers, but they do have an endless stream of carefully edited videos available to watch. Combat Obscura does not have answers to those questions either. So what is the film really about? In a way, it's like the Afghanistan war itself. The more you see, the less you understand, and then you start to forget the point of it all in the first place. And that was, The Marines Don't Want You to See What Happens When Propaganda Stops and Combat Begins, by Alex Horton. And half a century ago, I was a U.S. Marine Corps combat correspondent in Vietnam in 1966 and 67. My job was to travel with infantry and sometimes reconnaissance and record with pen and camera exploits by grunt and recon Marines. Our stories from the field were heavily edited, or in contemporary jargon, redacted, by military editors whose professional loyalties leaned much more toward prescribed policy than scruffy reality or truth. The censorship of military reporters was intense, but the truly worrisome effect upon us was the continual pressure to write what was presupposed, despite what had really happened. And if we strongly or subtly resisted the editor's sliced and spliced copy to meet the exigencies of accepted official propaganda, which was essentially that American soldiers and Marines never lost a battle, never committed atrocities, and unless it was unavoidable to mention, none died, only VC and NVA casualties, which were most often magnified, were to be mentioned in combat stories. Our stories featured body counts of VC and NVA, the true score of Vietnam, but not dead Vietnamese civilians, unless they were projected as victims of the Viet Cong or NVA soldiers. And more often than not, their deaths migrated over into the official VC-NVA body count. USMC casualties were generally not mentioned or were negligible if included for whatever purpose, and seldom did any of us get away with mentioning a dead Marine. Nobody dies, was our bitterly cynical shibboleth. As for our own casualties, we lost three dead while I was over there, two reporters and one photographer. Half a dozen were wounded or injured, a few seriously. So often that it was a joke, combat reporters read in military publications like the USMC Vietnam periodical Sea Tiger or in the Pacific edition of Stars and Stripes, stories that had our bylines that were so heavily edited or redacted, we hardly recognize them as other than officially endorsed fictions. Yet we knew the Catch-22 fabric of the war, and a few of us informed civilian journalists we could trust with truth and reality, and also who would not rat on us, to use a Trumpian metaphor. And we were also wary of those who substituted our stories with their own bylines, as if they were up front in the fray, rather than spending their expense accounts in Saigon watering holes and bordellos. A significant taboo was to report or even acknowledge the growing racial animus between whites and blacks in the military, which was intensified by the urban race riots stateside. It might seem somewhat ironic, but I consider the best story I wrote while I was in the USMC was after I left Vietnam on a six-month extension overseas as editor of the Iwakuni, Japan, Marine Air Wing Base. I was kicked out of Japan for that story, which I had been ordered by the base commander not to print. Fortunately, despite the risks to his contract with the USMC, the Japanese printer, Maguma-san, agreed to print it. Just before my enforced exit from Japan, many base Marines, black and white, claimed the article had at least temporarily cooled their racial animosity, and there was no riot. And this is what I wrote. The sound of guns. Their fierce staccato dominated the background as the news broadcaster described the action. You can hear the sounds of automatic weapons. There's a profusion of them here. They are returning fire against snipers, trying to clear them out. Vietnam? Unfortunately, no. Newark, New Jersey. Another race riot in a sweltering, bloody tradition of riots, leaving its dead behind like scattered cigar butts. For 3 years, the riot-torn summers have filled the newspapers and subsequently the worried minds of millions of confused Americans of every race. Judgment of these riots, with all their reasons, their passions, conditions, bloodshed and destruction, and unanswered questions, must be left to the conscience of humanity, individually and collectively, and to history. What concerns us here is the immediate effect they have on the armed forces, both black and white alike, who must live and work together, and in the extreme instance of Vietnam, must fight and possibly die together. Ironically, they fight together for what they have been told is for the freedom of someone else, yet they cannot escape the reality of strife amongst their races at home. The civil rights movement somewhat parallels the situation in Vietnam. You cannot force people to change their minds. However, in this particular instance, wrongs demand their redress. We as a nation are waging war because our leaders say it must be done for that reason. We cannot then expect otherwise, however right or wrong, from those within our society who have been wrong. If the military might be the only demonstrative proof of equality among the races, then use this unique position you are in to show the people back home it can be done. For God's sakes, do not regard one another as enemies. As you look upon one another embarrassed and wary, perhaps angry and suspicious, because of these recent riots, do not forget for an instant that you are all Americans, that to these people in Japan and other countries, you are nothing else. I have questioned you throughout the base and in the town where you have lamentably segregated yourselves into two districts, one black, one white, and you are ready to blow the lid off because you think it's inevitable. Can't you understand you are making it inevitable by believing it's inevitable, waiting for that one spark to set you at each other's throats? I am not concerned here in this article with the rights and wrongs of your beliefs or prejudices. Here I am pleading with you to cool it because I don't want to see you tearing up a third people's real estate. The Japanese have had to put up with enough from us already without getting clobbered on the periphery of a racial struggle 5,000 miles away. Face it, who will be hurt the most if you let this thing explode here? You or the Japanese sucked into the cyclone? You know damned well it will be the Japanese. Is it right for a third race to suffer because some hardheads from two others can't get along? Some of you do not like the Japanese, but admit it, those of you who do not generally don't like anybody other than yourselves and those who are most like you, whether you are black or white. That's what bigotry is all about. Look around you, in your barracks, in the hangars, on the flight line, and maybe you will discover the truth of the old saw that no argument is truly black or white. Look around you, and you will see, for the first time perhaps, that you are also Japanese American, you are Chinese American, Mexican American, American Indian. My God, the stew of you is infinite, and some of the roots are here in this land. Think about that before you cross that line. That can only lead to your own self-destruction and the destruction of everything you hold dear. And that was what I wrote for the Storyteller, which was the base publication. And as I said, I was kicked out of Japan. Many people came to sit with me on the airstrip as I waited for the airplane to Okinawa. Marines of both races who said I did the right thing and perhaps prevented a riot from occurring, which many more gave me credit for in letters to me later when it did not occur. Young service brats from the base, and also a smattering of Japanese friends, who also stood behind my article. A few of the young, both Japanese and American, sang peace songs accompanied to a couple of guitars. I felt both honored and humble. Others waiting for the plane watched the gathering quizzically. A few came over and joined us, including a civilian teacher who spent 2 years schooling the service brats and was going home. And I will finish this program with a story I wrote, which was never published by the Marine Corps. I called it Old Man. He was just an old man, bent and scabby-legged, sores all over his dark, calloused feet, three long chin whiskers curling from his ancient, crumbling jaw like nonsensical banners. He was waving one, a flag, yellow with three red stripes. He was standing beside his hut. Kids were running everywhere, yelling at the Marines walking through the village, a tiny village alongside a river. Chickens, ugly pigs, skinny dogs, scrawny old women with black teeth and frightened smiles because they thought the Americans might kill their men or burn down their homes. So everybody pretended to be friendly, and the old man hit his Viet Cong flag and brought out the Saigon absurdity, waving and smiling to beat hell. But Fat Jack saw him, and Fat Jack had never shot down anybody in cold blood. Jack had this thing. He wanted to kill somebody, and here was this ridiculous old man. Who would miss him? Just an old man. He couldn't work in the fields anymore. Another hungry stomach for a family loaded down with kids to feed. So Jack walked up to him, and the old man started bobbing his head up and down faster and smiling wider. But it didn't matter. Jack had the rifle in his face and the trigger pulled before the old man's body knew it was dead. He didn't fall. He just stood there without much of a face, a squashed, dripping berry. The back of his head looked like a busted balloon. Then he fell, old knees buckling on withered legs. His ass hit first, then the rest of him, sitting hunched over for a second, collapsing on his side. "I don't feel nothing," Jack shouted. The guys just smiled. The kids stopped running, quiet. The old women scooted back into their huts. A low wailing began to throb through the village, but Jack was walking away, shaking his head, telling his friends he just didn't feel nothing. The old man, he had a lot of blood for such a small, skinny, used-up old man. He was left to lay there. Nobody touched him, not the kids, not the women, just the flies, coming from all over the village, the fields. And I wrote that while I was in Vietnam. And though the Marine Corps would never touch it, it seems to get published all over the world. Somebody sees it in a book, magazine, or newspaper and reprints it. Sometimes I get paid for it, most often not. It has a life of its own and crops up in unusual places and publications. And it still might. This is Michael McCusker. Happy birthday, KMUN, and happy Easter.